On the Mic, voted podcast of the year by a panel of experts. A panel of non-experts. A couple of his closest mates. His mum. Yes.
Thanks, Mum. And my mum is the only person that sponsors this show on patreon.com. As embarrassing as it is, I'm going to say it. Thanks, Mum. She sponsors for $5 every month. And so she gets a mention in this podcast. If you would like to sponsor this podcast so we can continue to make it, please go to patreon.com/onthemic. Thanks, Mum. Welcome to today's episode with Greg Rust. He is a motorsports legend in this country, probably Australia's greatest ever motorsports commentator. This guy is right down there in the thick of it, in the pits, at the coalface, when all the action is unfolding. He's got so many great stories. He's hosted shows with Formula One race car driver Alan Jones, the late great Barry Sheen. We're going to talk about the Rush-style feature film being made about Barry Sheen by a mate of mine, Rod Morris, on the Gold Coast. Also chat about working in the pits, the technology of the cars, where it's all going. Are we going to have electric car races soon? Celebrity interviews. He's spoken to Arnie and heaps of other people like that. Very shortly, Greg Rust. I got a lot of energy today. I feel good. Hey, probably excited because the Sanctuary Cove International Film Festival is coming up. I started a film festival 3 years ago on the Gold Coast, probably 4 years ago, actually, when I had a feature film called Shooting Goldman, which you can watch for free on Vimeo if you want to check it out. Very weird, freaky kind of movie I made. But the film festival just spun off the back of that because we had this theater at Matt Hollywood, my best buddy, the Magician's Theater at Sanctuary Cove. And he said, let's do a film festival here. I got a lot of friends that work in the industry. You got a lot of friends? Let's do a film festival. Get them all here and have a party. Just so happens it's on my birthday weekend as well. So if you want to come, because you're a loyal listener to On The Mic, or maybe you've listened to it for the first time, I don't care, I'm going to give you a $75 ticket for free. No strings attached. Just email me with the subject matter, Mike, you're a loser, mike@onthemic.com, and I'll give you a free $75 ticket. How good is that? Hey, am I good to you? And I would love it if you also gave me a cheeky review on this podcast, and maybe even subscribe if you like it. Go on, you know you want to. Mike@onthemic.com. Anyone wants to enter their film as well, go to sanctuaryfilmfestival.com. We have some incredible unseen films from all over the world premiering on Saturday, the 26th of November. Hopefully you can make it. Third year on the Gold Coast, Sanctuary Cove. It's like a movie set. Golf buggies everywhere, amazing restaurants, the best golf courses. We will see you there on Saturday, the 25th of November. Right. Let's start this interview with Greg Rust.
Here at On The Mic, not only do you listen to us, we listen to you. You said you wanted a podcast from the legendary Mike Goldman. We listened. You said you wanted a podcast with fascinating interviews. We listened. You said you enjoyed being spanked every now and then, but you didn't want anyone out there to know. We listen. Oh, sorry.
Hello.
Hello, Greg Rust. Thruster. Rusty. What do you prefer?
Rusty is the one that kind of sticks because I've always had that since I was a little tacker. Thruster came about because I worked for a time with the legendary, the late Barry Sheen.
Barry Sheen.
Yes. Now, Russell Ingall, Supercars champion in 2005. He was already kind of called Rusty by a lot of people.
Oh, you can't have two Rusty.
Can't have two Rusty.
Especially when Russell Ingall's so popular.
Correct,
and so
correct.
Famous.
And Baz coined the nickname Thruster. Nothing dodgy about it, despite the tones.
That wasn't from some massive nights out.
I can only wish he was such a legend. I could only wish to have something like that have happened to me.
Had some great stories.
Legend.
Some wild times.
No, but he reckoned I marched up and down the pit lane with my chest out and sort of thrust the microphone in there and asked the question. Oh. And it's a bit of all that. That's kind of how it all came about.
So you're a mic thruster.
Apparently.
Well, that's a good way to introduce you on a podcast called On The Mic. You've been thrusting mic for years and you mentioned the pit lane. Must be a dangerous job.
People worry that it is. I can vividly recall having a discussion with OH&S people about where I stand and what I do, and this is going back 10 years ago now. But no, mate, really, it just comes about via experience. You kind of walk in the opposite direction to the cars, so you can always see them coming. There's been some hairy moments, but they're big in our game on safety and they're constantly navel-gazing. So
dangerous for you? I mean, you look at people walking down the street with their iPod on, but you're walking through a pit lane with headphones on and a director and a producer talking to you in your ear saying, you need to stand here, you need to talk to this person. So it can be even more dangerous for you.
And yet I see that person with the iPod or their phone looking down, not watching the crossing, as being far more dangerous than me. Yeah. Far more dangerous. Yeah. They're not dialed in, switched on to what's going on around them. All the cars and trucks and everything. Whereas that's what I'm meant to be there to do. Mm. I'm acutely aware of who's coming in the pit lane and why, and the experience of where to stand in dangerous moments. And I feel far safer.
What about the naked flame? You know, like in that movie with Will Ferrell, what is it? Ricky Bobby, the ballad of Ricky Bobby.
Help me. Help me, Tom Cruise.
I'm on fire. I'm burning up. I'm on fire. What am I doing? Is that true? Is there really like a naked flame in motorsports that you can't see?
In some kinds of motorsport there are, not in supercars in Australia. If there were to be a fire, there's only been very rare instances of that.
I had been close.
I was close to John Bowe's car at Queensland Raceway one year. He was sharing it with Jimmy Richards when it erupted in flames, and I can vividly recall the sensation, the heat, the way it sort of rushed up past you. And I was quite a distance from the car.
You could feel it.
They never sit still in our game. They always look at ways to prevent that from happening again.
Yeah, it's getting more and more dangerous. So, like, I'm by no means a motorsports expert. I sit there and watch it occasionally, and I watch Bathurst, and you know, you learn as you're watching when you're in, from my perspective, where I don't know a huge amount about it. But I've been watching a little bit of F1 lately, and in the news, there's a lot of new technologies that they're trying to push for that apparently are making it more dangerous than ever.
I think the exact opposite, to be honest with you. The by nature, when you go into a racetrack, you have the back of your ticket, it says the game is dangerous. Yeah. That's a reality. But
that's just for the people sitting in the stands.
But you know what? We have an impeccable record, mate, really. And they are, as I said before, they're constantly looking at ways to make things safer, better. In Formula One, they've looked for many years now at a lot of the technology that they have in, say, cockpits in fighter jets and how they can incorporate something like that to make it safer for the F1 driver.
Like an ejector seat with a parachute?
Not quite, but like a canopy. And it's caused a huge amount of controversy because, aesthetically, that might take it to the next generation of fans. It's a different look, and young kids might sort of think that's quite a cool thing. But, you've got to think about safety. How does a driver get out in those situations? So they've looked a lot at the moment about what they're calling the halo, which is a bit like a ring that runs around the top of the driver's head to aid in ensuring that their head is safe in the event of a rollover or a crash into a barrier and things like that. And they've tested a lot of that at the moment, quite extensively.
So it would sit around like a big headband around the top of his head.
Correct. Essentially, just above them. So it gives the car a very different look. A lot of hardcore fans don't like it because it's taking away from the traditional look of the Formula One car. But the
dangerousness of it.
Yeah, but I like the fact that they're not sitting still. Really, over the past 20 years, there's been incidents. Probably the most high profile one was the passing of Ayrton Senna in 94. But since then, there's this constant quest, mate, not to sit still with that. It can be perceived to be a dangerous game, but honestly, with some of the standards of driving in our country, which I think are terrible compared to other countries, I feel far safer at a racetrack than I do walking out on the street now or driving on the road with a lot of people.
Which state in Australia do you think has the worst drivers?
Ooh, that's hard. That's hard. I just think as a nation generally, I mean, a politician, if we were sitting here now, would shoot me down and tell me that there is data that disproves what I'm about to say. But I strongly believe that driver training is, we don't do enough of it in this country. If you look at what's required in, say, Nordic countries to get your driver's license, it's far tougher. Mm. A lot more training involved. I think it would help our driving standards in this country. Pollies tend to believe that it will empower young men to do silly things on the road, and I massively disagree with that.
Yeah, so if a kid does something bad with his car, like he's doing burnouts or whatever, he should have to do a driver training course and pass tests again to get his license again.
Even before then, yeah. I mean, okay, that could be a form of punishment, but even beforehand, it should be tougher for them to get it in the first place, that they understand it's a deadly weapon, it requires respect. But importantly, I'm a huge believer, mate, that there's places for appropriate speed. I live my life at a racetrack. Yeah. That if you want to go and do that stuff with a flash car, take it for where the maker designed or intended for it to be used. Don't you know, it's not safe to do that stuff.
You ever
on
lost
streets.
Your license?
Never, no.
I have a couple of times.
How did you lose your license?
Well, I lost. Actually, I don't have a license at the moment.
No way.
I was driving up to Queensland and I thought, oh, this is an open stretch of roads, no cars around. It's the only time I sped the whole way. I reckon I was doing about 140. And I had another fine earlier for having the chin strap undone on my helmet when I was just riding down to the beach in Bondi. And they got me for that. It's $300 fine and 3 points.
Yeah.
And so that added up to losing my license, unfortunately. But they pinged me.
But a lid like that, a helmet, mate, can come off so easily if it's not done up.
I'm just going to the beach. I just know. A few streets away. Yeah. Yeah, that's when the accidents happen. That's You're right. Mate. How old were you when you got your license?
I was 17 and 3 days, so I can vividly
recall.
I know exactly. I'm one of my best mates from high school and I, we got our license at exactly the same times. His driver's license number is one digit different to mine. We're best mates from
high
school.
Mine's a radio station number, 773 FM. Isn't that weird?
I got it as soon as I could get it. I was one of the older guys in my year, so I was lucky enough to drive to school at the end, and I've just loved driving ever since.
And so you were just hanging to get your license.
Pretty much.
You've always loved cars.
Pretty much.
Always known a lot about cars.
It's not like I didn't have my moments. I did something crazy on the way to school one day, and the police were going in the other direction, and they couldn't stop at the time, but they took the number plate and they rang home later that night, and Mum took the phone call, and all I could hear was Mum going, "Really? Is that right? Okay, thank you. And yes, officer, he won't be behind the wheel of the car for about a month." So that was my punishment.
There goes grounded. What kind of car did you have?
It was a VC 1980 Holden Commodore. It was Mum's. It was brown with a gold stripe.
Oh, nice.
I thought it was gun. And my first car, I can remember my old man coming to help me buy it, was a beige Holden Gemini SLX four-door. I thought it was gold, mate, beige.
And like you never did any burnouts.
I learned the hard way with stupid things. Mm. So I blew an engine up and had to get that fixed and stuff like that. But, mate, I honestly preach it now, but I learned very early on that the best way to get that stuff out of my system was to...
Go to the track.
And Dad was great with that. He helped me with karting and things, and I'm a big believer in that. Young guys, they love these cars, but the best place for them, just take them to a racetrack, take them to a drag strip. That's what they're meant for.
How many goes do you think it took me to get my license?
I got a first go. I reckon.
First go.
I reckon I got a first go.
Show off.
I reckon you're a third time lucky. Yeah.
More.
How many?
Guess.
I'll say 5.
More.
No way. Why were you getting? Why were you losing your life?
It took me 13 goes to get my license. 13.
What fundamentals were you doing wrong?
Oh, just it was stupid stuff. Like in the paper, in the Manly Daily, the first week I went for my license, there was a bribery scandal going on with the motor registry where people were showing up and, you know, giving gifts to the guys doing the tests.
Yeah.
And so they weren't passing anyone. Like all my mates at school were failing as well. But they were getting like second and third go. And by the third go, I didn't get it. And I was getting failed for things like dirty windscreen, for starting the car and then putting my seatbelt on.
He was a tough marker, this guy.
Almost running into a truck.
Yeah, that's not good.
But in about the fourth or fifth go, I could say this now because it's 20 years ago, but I figured out a little loophole in the system because, you know, they didn't have the internet, wasn't hooked up very well back then in the day and age. And I would go at Manly for my test and I'd fail and I'd get in a car and I'd drive to North Sydney and do another test
crack
on the same day and still fail. And I wish I had video footage of me in the car screaming and shaking the steering wheel in crazed anger, like that Michael Douglas movie, Falling Down.
How was that sense of elation when you got it though then?
When I got, I cried with happiness. And because my dad was happy because he didn't have to drive me to my mobile disco jobs anymore.
Uh-huh.
Even though sometimes I might have driven myself. I'm not saying you should do that. I was a young, stupid kid. Hey, so you raced in go-karts, did you say?
Correct.
What was that like?
It was excellent.
Good way to get you started in motorsports.
And it was a great family thing too. Like Dad would always come to the track with me and he was far better with the mechanical stuff than I was. He's loved Speedway and all his life pretty much. And he and Mum would take me to the Speedway as a youngster. So it was great to be able to actually compete and do a few things. I realized early on, mate, when you get the opportunity to compete against a Marcus Ambrose or a Mark Webber or any of those guys. That didn't happen often, but when it did, I realised they were just at a whole new level, whole nother level. And I wanted to stay involved in the game that I'm doing now, but I knew I could never cut it as a driver. I love it. I still get a huge amount
of
enjoyment.
Why is that? Why did you know you could never cut it?
Because you can see them, mate. When they overtook you, when they pulled certain moves, when they did certain things, they have this sort of innate nature, this deft touch, and they do things that don't come easily to you. You could probably learn to do it, but it would take a long time, so, whereas they do it naturally.
They have a natural ability.
Correct.
It just comes to them. And
correct.
And so they can drive faster, like they can turn corners better.
They feel it. They feel it. They sense it. They'll do things two and three steps ahead of you. And I just knew that I was never going to be able to do that. I was just in awe of them, really. And so this was a different way to stay involved. And I still do I try and do something once a year, but normally it's a charitable thing, a fun thing. It's just a great experience. And I walk away from those things going, that was awesome. Get it out of the system.
What's the fastest you've ever gone?
I drove once at Avalon Airport in a Holden Monaro with Stephen Richards. We were both able to – the airport was closed. And I had it tapped out. It was nearly 300 or close to 300 k's an hour. Something like that. That was awesome. Yeah.
That's cool. Mm. Who do you think is the best driver in Australia in the V8 supercars?
That's hard. Right now, as you and I sit and chat, Scott McLaughlin, the Kiwi, is in vintage form, mate. He looks like being his year, but it seriously is one of the toughest, most competitive years we've seen. Shane Van Gisbergen, who won the championship last year, another Kiwi. The Kiwis are dominating at the moment. Just about anything he gets behind the wheel of, mate, he's incredibly adept at. He can get in a speedway car, he can get out of that, get in a supercar, and he's equally competitive. Just driving is in his blood, mate. He's exceptionally good.
Yeah, yeah. Cool. So what about the best driver of all time out of Australia? We say like Peter Brock, I suppose. Or
I mean, I was lucky enough to in the latter part of his career, do some things with him. What I liked about him, I mean, he was genuinely a good driver, but was his personality outside the car, mate. He was a great human being. Did so much for, you know, young kids coming through in terms of mentoring, and he was excellent with the fans. But in that period there in the 70s and 80s, I mean, it just anything he got behind the wheel of, he'd drive the wheels off it, but he was brilliant at it.
Yeah, his rally car driving?
All sorts. I mean, at the end, yes, at tarmac rallies, and sadly there was the one in Perth or WA where he got killed. I mean, he did some rallying when he was younger in the 70s. I mean, he drove all kinds of different things, really, but we know him for the bigger chunk of his career with Holden and for what he did, particularly at Bathurst. And
how many did he win in Bathurst?
Nine.
Was it nine? Wow.
He won other events up there and other classes and things, but of the main race, the great race, he won nine of them, and he helped make that place.
Who was his main rival back then? I remember the guy with the glasses.
Alan Moffat.
That's right.
Yeah. Lovely, lovely man to this day. And ironically, mate, you know, back then everyone traded on that rivalry, and then in later years, obviously with Dick Johnson. But I saw Alan speak a few years ago at an event in Melbourne, and he spoke very emotionally about it because he described Peter as a very good friend. They may have been rivals on track, but had this great respect. And they even drove together in the latter part of each other's career in the 80s there and things. So, yeah.
Like you'd see him when you're watching Wide World of Sports and the highlights of their races and the duels that they had against each other over the years, and they'd be waving their fists at each other. You thought they hated each other's guts.
Sport's built on that, mate, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, like I can recall all kinds of, in motor racing, events where you know, they're unforgettable moments in history, those, when they've happened. Dick Johnson, when he hit the rock at the top of the mountain. I mean, that was the kind of making of him in a funny roundabout way.
He punched someone.
No.
He hit the rock.
He literally hit the rock, and it badly damaged the car. And he was.
I thought the rock was another driver.
No, not like the rock. I mean, long story short, the Australians felt so sad for him. There was this outpouring of support for Dick Johnson, lots of donations and things, and that helped keep his motor racing career on track. And he came back the following year in the early 1980s and won Bathurst. And it just, he went from being on, you know, like in a current affair type show where people were talking about this this support for him to coming back and clinching it the following year. It was a great comeback.
So what would you equate Bathurst to if someone's listening in America right now?
Yep.
What kind of motorsport touring race would it be?
It's a different style of racetrack, but they have an awesome event over there called the Indianapolis 500. They have another thing called the Daytona 500.
But they're just round and round and round, aren't they?
Yeah, but I love those style of races because there's a huge amount that goes into it from a strategic point of view, from a car point of view, a driver point of view. But those two venues, Daytona on the East Coast there, and then Indianapolis, world famous racing venues, and ours, Bathurst is Australia's, I guess, version of that. It's not round and round, as you say. It's not a circuit or an oval, I should say. It's a circuit.
Why don't they do those? I don't see those races in the States.
They do have them. I mean, for example, they have a 24-hour race at Daytona where they use some of the banking, but also a section of the infield, so it becomes a proper course. And they do a famous 24-hour race there in January every year.
I don't know how they do that race for 24 hours.
That'd
be exhausting. I hate driving from the city to Bondi.
Yeah, but you do it with a team of people and you share the driving.
What's the longest they drive for if they did that 24-hour race?
In kilometre terms?
Hours.
There'd be normally it's a team of four drivers and they split it up. Depends on the event, but at Bathurst, for example, no one driver can do more than, I think it's two-thirds of the race distance. So it's 161 laps or 1,000 kilometres. Mm. So if the day unfolds where, you know, there's a bit of rain or things change and strategically you need to keep that bloke in the car for a little while longer, you can do that. But that driver can't do more than two-thirds of the race. And it gets to a point where the quality of the racing now is so good, you have to be on it the entire time. Like to sit behind the wheel for 2 hours like that, you're not as... You need a break.
They listen to music?
So before the race,
put on a bit of death metal or some classical music?
Not in the car. Not in the car. Some of the GT cars or sports cars now have air conditioning and things like that in them to keep them a little bit cooler. And
I would have thought they'd all have that now.
No, not all of them. No, a supercar in particular is...
They need to be light.
Devoid of a lot of those things. They're very aero efficient. And I mean, at some tracks, a supercar now, the temperature is sort of mid-50s inside the car and you've got a triple layer racing suit and a helmet on. It's hard work.
You need to be fit.
They're proper athletes. I mean, Will Davison just... yesterday, before you and I sit here for this podcast, was doing an Ironman event up on the Sunshine Coast. And he's a super fit guy.
What would he do to train? Would he do not just drive the car? I mean,
A lot of cycling's a big one. The rules of motor racing now at the upper end prevent you from doing too much testing, so it keeps the cost down, so people aren't out there all the time.
Right.
So, like anything, in situ, doing match fit stuff is what's really important. But if you can't do that, you've got to subject your body in another way to prepare it for the rigors of that. So cycling for long periods, it's an endurance form of fitness, mate.
So did you say that they're not allowed to race their cars as much as they like to do training and practice?
Testing away from events during the year, you might only get 2 or 3 days of that. There's very limited.
I would have thought if they got lots of money, they could train every day of their life.
Back in the days of the tobacco sponsorship and things, they used to do heaps of that. But now they're big on, we've got to try and contain the costs.
Right.
So
that'll make the competition probably a bit closer as well.
It's terrific, mate. I mean, the guys who can roll up to the racetrack, sort the car out pretty quickly and with a good driver, There is a difference between the haves and have-nots. Yeah. That's a part of any kind of motor racing. But when you're at the point of a Formula One team that had a unlimited budget and would test...
Like the Red Bull team. Who's got the most? Would it be McLaren, Red Bull?
No, I'd say Mercedes Grand Prix at the moment have the biggest budget. I think they have...
They spend like $1 billion a year or something crazy.
I don't know whether it's a billion, but I mean, they've got a staff of over 1,000 people working on two race cars and... Red Bull have a very significant spend in the area of motorsport in particular. Yeah, they're big on that.
Do you reckon it'll ever go to electric?
I mean, there's a huge push towards that right now. The last category that Mark Webber competed in before he retired from driving, the World Endurance Championship, the cars cleverly blended a lot of hybrid technology. I think that stuff is phenomenal. So
happening
there's
still already.
Yeah, it's happening already, and there is a championship actually called Formula E, which is an emerging championship. It has lots of either ex-Formula One drivers or engineers that have that caliber, and it's all electric.
Formula E, I haven't even heard of that.
Yeah, you should have a look at that. It's not everyone's cup of tea. A lot of motor racing purists don't like it, but there is a very concerted push in that area at the moment, particularly among the corporate sector who want it to be cleaner and greener.
So how would it work? Would they just charge the battery and they just go for a few hours?
As you and I sit here and talk at the moment, they actually have two cars. So there's there's a change of car.
It's just like a relay. It's a bit weird, isn't it?
It's a race, but that'll change over time. The way their rules are going, the battery technology with everything that we're involved in, you know, from Tesla with cars to some of the stuff that they're doing with, you know, battery systems that are connected to your solar energy on your roof and things. I mean, that's just exploding, all that technology.
Yeah. I wonder if they'll ever do drone races. Like, they do it with the drone around a track. But
you can actually...
Drone cars. I mean, Tesla got self-driving cars, but will they have self-driving race cars?
I hope not. I hope that it still remains the kind of thing where kids go, even if our daily life, which it will... And they reckon my kids now are approaching their teens, and they reckon that that generation will be the last to have a driver's license.
The next
group of kids that come through, so they say, will be, you know, going to work in a driverless car or going to school in a driverless car. I still hope that motor racing is seen as, you know, these gladiators. Wow, they actually pull a helmet on it and they actually drive those things. It's not a drone. Wow, that's pretty cool, and I hope it stays that way.
Have you ever had a go at a Tesla or any of those cars?
I have.
They probably lent you one. You get a lot of free stuff, don't you? Apparently you're the king of free stuff.
I'm not the king of free stuff.
How's the Lexus going?
The Lexus was good. It was good. the Tesla I drove probably about 12 months ago now, and it was amazing to see the kids' reaction. The kids...
Which one?
Love both of them.
The X with the doors that go up?
No.
I had one of those the other day.
They're an amazing car. And it you know, you unlock ludicrous mode and things like that.
Ludicrous mode.
They're an incredible car, and it really changed my thinking. I'm a bit of a traditionalist. I like a supercar or a Formula One or whatever in terms of a petrol-powered formula. But the sheer torque and grunt this thing had, I couldn't get over that it was just electric.
So quick off the
mark,
aren't
they? Amazing. Yep.
I was in at the Tesla store in Martin Place in Sydney the other day, and I was just checking it out. I was wearing boardies and a t-shirt, like one of those classic scenes where the salesperson would look at you and go, this guy's not going to buy one. But this nice French girl came up and started having a chat to me about the car, and she goes, would you like it for the night? I'm like, what? Are you coming with me? And she's, no. You know, it's better to send it out for the night rather than having it in the in the showroom. Yeah. And they're like, she didn't know me or who I was or anything like that. I'm like, yeah, sure. So my girlfriend and I took it for a drive all the way up to Palm Beach, had dinner up there, went around visiting our friends, and we'd stop at the lights because it was the X, and you push the button and the doors would open up and everyone would be looking at you. People would try to cross the road and they're like, what the hell's that car? It was so much fun. And the next morning it was on empty as I was driving to Martin Place. It was like I didn't have the charger at home or anything like that. And I'm freaking out, like, this is going to run out in the middle of the street. But we got there in the end and just whacked it on the charger. But it was such an incredible experience. There's so much room on the inside. You can put stuff in the bonnet and in the boot as well.
Amazing car.
Such a cool car. Yep. Incredible technology.
You know, and he's doing some amazing things from taking it from a car that's sort of upper end of the market to more mass market now, and that'll come with lots of challenges. But yeah, there's a real push in that area, and the way that technology can recapture energy and reuse it is phenomenal.
Yeah,
I think,
in the motion of the tires and putting it back into the battery and all that
sorts,
kind of stuff.
All sorts. Yeah,
you can adjust that on the Tesla. So you know, when you take your foot off the accelerator, you can feel the wheels slowing the car down because it's charging the battery.
Yep.
It's bizarre, isn't it? Elon Musk is such a fucking legend.
That guy
is doing so many incredible things. Like, he's putting together a mission to Mars. He's talking about putting this Hyperloop into the ground where, you know, you could travel.
Crazy video, that thing, I know, wasn't it? Awesome.
Like, and even the this rail system, have you seen that, where you'll pull your car up to the side of the road and you park on this little leverage system, and you go into the ground and it shoots you to wherever you got to go. Like, some of the stuff that he's coming up with is incredible.
The world's changing, mate, but in some good ways. And I hope from a motoring point of view that, you know, if it does become a situation where driverless cars rule the road or rule the sky or however it may work, that motor racing still is a bit of an aspirational sport for these gladiators. It's still actually steering.
Speaking of driverless cars, I was looking at videos on the web the other day, and I did a bit of a Google search on you, and I actually saw you driving a driverless car at about 200 k's an hour.
Me?
Yeah. You're probably one of the first people to ever do it.
I don't think so. Where was that?
Basically you were driving along and the steering wheel fell off.
That's very true.
Oh my God.
I've never lived that down.
What's that all about?
One of the rare times that I've done a bit of racing, as I said to you before, I do a little bit each year. I try and do something. So I drove what's called an Aussie racing car, little pocket rocket. They've got a motorcycle engine in them. And for whatever reason, the steering wheel was not properly on the spline. And it may have, from memory, even been my fault that in getting into the car, because you have to take the wheel off, sort of maneuver yourself in, then put the wheel on. You're in quite tight confines there. So I'm roaring around at Winton in Victoria, and the wheel came off. I was very lucky, mate.
Did the front wheels just keep going straight, or did they just wobble all over the place?
I freakishly was coming into a right-hander, not at very high speed, and it popped off the spline before I turned in, and the car just kind of continued in a straight direction onto the grass, and I popped on the spline and kept going. And my friends, because this was as a support event to the supercar. So all the drivers that I know and I deal with now were wailing, mate. They were wailing.
Was your first reaction, I've got to put it back on, or actually get your hands and grip the little pole and turn the pole?
I was seated uncomfortably because that driving suit needed a full dry clean after that. But yes, I did. First thing was, I've got to get it back on the spline and double check that it's on properly.
Pole dancing.
In the heat of the rejoin on the racetrack, I was so flustered I missed a gear, and oh, mate, it was horrendous.
Is that probably one of your most embarrassing moments in motorsports?
Yeah, 100%, because it happened in front of your peers, and they've never let me forget it. Surprise, surprise.
I mean, working with Barry Sheen and Alan Jones for all those years that you did on Channel 10, how long were you at Channel 10 for, like 15 years or something crazy?
Yeah.
And so, some of the jokes that they play on each other, and, you know, they'd be saying to you and Barry Sheen on the track, cracking jokes left, right and centre. There must have been some fun times you had with those guys.
Unforgettable for me. It was a great period of television in this country, and they're legends for different reasons. Baz would give me relationship advice, mate. He'd always say, listen here. Start out as you mean to continue, right? Don't go giving them all flowers and going, you know, start out as you mean to continue. So he was...
Play hard to want, not hard to get.
He was incredible, mate. He was so good with the fans. And if you and I were sitting here doing this in the heart of London and he was still alive, I mean, there would have been paparazzi outside. He was proper rock star over there.
Only reason why I moved to Australia was for the warmer weather, because he had all these pins in his legs. A good mate of mine, Rod Morris, is making a movie about Barry Sheen, the biopic, which you might have heard about.
I can't wait to see it.
Yep. Yeah, they're just looking for a director at the moment. There's a few up in the air, but as soon as that happens, I think it's going to snowball and actually happen. And Rod lives up at Sanctuary Cove on the Gold Coast, and that's where the Sanctuary Cove International Film Festival is, which he helps run. And he actually has, I was at his house about a year ago, and he has Barry Sheen's original X-rays, all the pins in his legs. Have you ever seen that?
I can vividly recall going to the house in the early days of my career there, and we had to do some interview bits and pieces, and he says, "Here, come into the office with me." So we went into the office, and he had a steel hollow leg, and in it were all the bolts and pins and rods and everything from over the time in his career, and he upended or tipped it up on the desk, and I couldn't get over the volume of metal that he'd had in him over time. And I mean, that literally, mate, it would set off at certain airports. It would set off the X-ray machines. He was amazing guy. Great character. He was very much an adopted Aussie in this country. They loved him at the supercars as much as they did at the bikes. Yeah, it was huge.
He had a shocking accident in his career. Was it at
Daytona?
Daytona.
Well, actually, two. To be fair, one at Silverstone, one in the UK, and one at Daytona. The Daytona one was probably the first big one, and I mean, they did a documentary on his recovery from that, which was probably as big a part of the making of Baz as the other, you know, aspects of his life and times. But just the extent of the injuries and how he came back from it, a remarkable guy.
Yeah, and I believe this, the record still stands. He's the only rider to have won the 50cc and the 500cc GP in the same year.
Ooh, I'd have to go back. You're testing my knowledge.
I Googled it.
You Googled it?
And I remembered it just to make out like I knew what I was talking about.
I mean,
but he had some huge titles, didn't
he? Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, to win the 500cc world title twice was massive for the UK, but it was what he did off the bike that was just as huge on the bike. I mean, great friend of James Hunt. So there's two guys that were, you know, just rock stars in the day. You know, he did stuff. He had a relationship with Rolls-Royce. He took Rolls-Royce and made it a cool, hip thing to have again, and did some great ads and you know, even stuff here in Australia with Dick Johnson. I mean, it was his character as much as what he did
on
the bike.
Do you want anything from his side? Like maybe a sock?
I want a sock for. You know, those ads still get a run now. And
they probably didn't write that like that. He probably just did it on the spot.
He was great with off-the-cuff stuff like that. He would always say before we went into a broadcast, the director would be counting down, we were seconds from going to air, and he'd look at me and he'd go, "Here, let's have a laugh," because he knew that although there was a seriousness to the competition, to the contest, to the, you know, whatever it might have been, the controversy we were dealing with at the time, he knew it was important that if we had a giggle, the audience would enjoy it too.
Yeah. And didn't he meet his wife when she was already married to someone else? And she asked if she could borrow his racing suit. And he said, "Yeah, sure, as long as you as long as you go on a date with me." And she's like, "I'm married." "That's all right, we'll be married soon." Or something crazy like that. Because I had a browse over the script of his autobiography, the biopic, and it's got some incredible stories in there of him and his womanizing and how he was just a rock star when he was the world champ all those years ago. It's going to be an awesome movie.
But I still remember him being a great grounded person, mate. You know, he had never sort of really got to him. He was always very good with the fans, always had a laugh with him. It's just great fun working with him, mate. Very special to do
you
that.
You should be in the movie. You should be one of the commentators in the movie. How's your British accent?
Yeah. I mean, if they get close to making something like Rush or thereabouts,
that's what they're chasing.
That'll be, I mean, and it's a good story. It's a really good story. He's you know, globally loved. I mean, he could speak like five different languages and he was just mega, mate.
Five languages? Wow, I didn't know that.
Yep.
Oh, it's going to be cool. Oh, I hope you get a role.
No.
I'm trying to get a role in it. Rodney Morris, come on, we're plugging the film already.
Good luck with it, mate.
I'm sure it's going to be awesome. Yeah. Speaking of celebrities, I believe you've had a couple of chats with people like Arnie. Arnold Schwarzenegger, and what was I talking to him?
You can probably do the accent better than I can.
Get to the chopper. What are you doing, Greg Glass?
He came to the Grand Prix in Melbourne twice.
Yeah.
And did the podium, I think, one year, and was on the grid for both of them. So when I spoke, Arnold, how did you find the cars and being on the grid? Oh, I was amazing. You're the power, and you know all that sort of stuff.
And loving the power of the cars. Thank you very much. Anyone else over the years you might have chatted to? Because celebrities come from all over the world to go to the F1.
I played a great gag on the late, great Peter Brock at one stage, and he always swore to get even with me. It's a long story, probably too long for this podcast.
No, mate, we got as long as we want. It's not like a radio station where you got to get to the song or the ad break, and I'm the program manager, so I can do whatever the fuck I want.
We were driving back from the Pukekohe track in New Zealand to Auckland. About an hour trip was at the New Zealand round of the supercars, and as we're driving along, Neil Crompton, Matty White, myself, Darrell Beatty, we can see Brock a couple of cars in front of us. So I get his number and I ring him, you know, in silent mode so he doesn't know that it's me, and I put on this Kiwi radio announcer accent and ask, could I do an interview with him? I said, "Oh, g'day, Pete, it's Chris here from Hauraki FM, how are you?" And I can hear him, good, thanks, and you know, probably looking for his schedule of things to do for the day, and I didn't have this interview listed and blah, 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 blah. I said, "Oh, look, Pete, I'd really love if we could just have a quick chat about today's supercars action at Pukki." "Oh, okay, sure." And so I then rattle into the whole spiel that you and I would do. "Okay, well, I'll just get some tape rolling, and here we go, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Well, I'm with one of the absolute legends of Australian motorsport now, Peter Brock. Pete, you know," so we talk about the racing for the day and how well Greg Murphy had gone and Mark Scaife and what have you. Yeah. Crompton's driving our commentator's minivan, and by this stage he's worked his way up beside Brock in the traffic. And we look across at him, and it was in the days of earpieces, and he's doing the right thing, driving along with his earpiece in, and he looks across at us and he points at the earpiece and he goes, "I'm on the radio." He sort of mouths the words, "I'm on the radio." So we keep doing this interview, and I said, Pete, just in closing, what are you doing now? And he said, you wouldn't believe it. I'm driving back to Auckland. There's a crazed carload of Supercars fans right beside me. It's been a huge day here. At which point I turned and I looked him square in the eye and I said, they're not in a blue Tarago, are they? And he realised he'd been had and
got him.
And he loved it, mate. Not all celebs take gags like that real well. Yeah. And he always swore to get even with me. Sadly, that didn't happen. But, yeah, great. He loved the gotcha.
What a legend. We love Brocky. Great Australian. A hero. So what's the future hold for you, Mr. Rust? Mr. Thrust? Greg Rust?
I love what I'm doing at the moment, mate. I'm kind of freelance in the middle. I do a bit of stuff with Fox, a bit of stuff with 10, with Supercars again. But I've done a few overseas things. I did a bit of stuff with Red Bull TV last year.
Cool. Will you ever do the Olympic Games or Commonwealth Games or anything like that? Because you did Glasgow.
I did Glasgow, and I did the Winter Games. But only studio-based stuff for that. I really enjoyed doing that with the guys at 10. If the window was there and the opportunity came up, for sure, I you know, at heart, I love automotive. I love cars. Mm. I love bikes. I think that's when I'm speaking from the heart about that stuff, that's probably where I'm at my best. But it's been a huge, huge thing to go and dabble in those other sports, mate. Yeah,
you are pretty amazing at it, and you know, you've got so much cred in the industry. I was just talking to Michael Strano from Sports.
Good man.
He's a good mate of mine. Actually, he got me to be the voice of Speed TV. Remember, he's doing the Speed Channel.
Yeah, Speed
but
Channel.
He get me to do it as loud and as angry as I could. So this week on the Speed Channel, we go to Silverstone where they're racing nonstop. It's like it was so full on. And once he got me to do the voiceover with a helmet on, I had the Speed Racing helmet on. I went on YouTube. I think he got at least 10 hits. But Aaron, I think, that works there as well, or who's the other guy?
Andrew Hawkins, maybe?
Yeah.
AJ,
that's it. AJ's a legend too. Love working with those guys. But they rave about you, and actually I hit him up and said, give me some dirt on Thruster, on Rusty. And they said he just loves free stuff. Just hit him up and say what kind of
that's
free stuff he got.
Harsh. That is very harsh.
Ask him about his Lexus.
No. I got to drive that. I do a little bit of Instagramming, as you know. I love that stuff.
And you got to in this day and age. You got to put yourself out there all the time, let people know what you're doing.
For me, when I post that stuff, it's not about me. It's about the car or the bike. I love that stuff, mate.
Yeah. What are you scored lately? What bikes? What cars?
I'm in a four-wheel drive, as you and I sit here. I'm driving a. It's not for me. It's a press car. So I sample it for a few days and I give it back. So I'm.
What do you got?
I want to, if I can, next year. I want a family truckster, mate. I want either a Ford Ranger or a Colorado Z71 or something like that. But I'm actually trying at the moment an Isuzu D-Max of all things.
What's it like?
Yeah, it's not too bad. There's potential Ford Ranger next week, and then maybe a VW Amarok. So I've tried a Nissan Navara and a BT50. I've tried a few different things, but there's a cool maybe. I've got my fingers crossed. I might be driving a McLaren in the coming weeks.
What?
Is that a million dollar car? No. It's not the
million dollar
jobby,
like
but
half
it's
a million
yeah,
dollars
correct, correct. So
is that got one seat in the front and
no,
two in the back?
No, you're talking about
that's another
one. One of the earliest incarnations was that setup, and it was really cool, mate. That's a very memorable.
Didn't Mr.
car,
Bean
though.
Have one of them?
Yes, he did, and he crashed it, mate. Yeah, and he crashed it and had to have it repaired.
I love the story.
I think he sold that now.
I love the story when he crashed it. He ran up the back of some little old lady. He got out. And she was about to abuse him, and then she realized it was Mr. Bean. She just pissed herself.
Bean, I'm sorry.
He loves his cars, and you often see him turn up at Formula One races and things like that. Yeah,
That'll be fun driving around a McLaren.
Mm. If it happens.
Well, what about motorbikes? You get a few of them too? Do you ride many bikes?
I do. Since the kids come along, I haven't owned one for a while, but I rode a Ducati in the past 12 months. Often do some things with either KTM or Honda. But honestly, mate, the size of the bike, I'm not a guru. A 600 to an 800 is probably big enough for me. 1,000 kind of sort of scares me. They're a bit too big for my limited ability. I have done over time, in terms of ticking some wonderful boxes career-wise, I've been for a ride in a 2-seater F1 car at Albert Park. That was huge.
Oh, wow.
And I've also done the 2-seater Ducati MotoGP ride at Phillip Island.
Oh, that'd be scary.
That was mind-blowing, mate.
Who was driving?
So he's ex 500cc racer, Randy Mamola, famous legend. And they were all – it was, you know, during the Grand Prix weekend down there, so all my buddies were winding me up about it. Mm. And he said to me, look, he goes, you ride bikes? I said, yeah, but I'm a amateur. And he goes, yeah, but you know
How
about
lean.
Leaning. And, yeah. and he said, just go with me. So he said, you've got to literally, you sit on the back of the bike, you reach around the rider, and on the tank there are some carbon fiber grips. Mm. And you grip onto those as best you can, but you, in midst of it, when he's turning to the right or turning to the left, you lean in that direction with him.
And were you scared you were going to lean too far?
Oh, mate. There was one point there where I felt like I could reach out with my little pinky and touch the ripple strip.
What?
And
how does it stick to the road?
It's
like
amazing.
That?
It's amazing. And, you know, like the moment we got going on the main straight there at the island, he let the clutch out. When he grabbed second gear, he let the clutch out and we were up on the back wheel. He kept accelerating, still on the back wheel in third gear, still on the back wheel in fourth gear. So we were pulling a mono for ages.
What?
Put the wheel down. We turned into turn one and I did three laps with him and I was knackered because you you literally are bracing. You're pushing back when you're under brakes, coming into the corners. It's taking all of your might. And then because you're doing nearly 300 k's an hour on the main straight, you're holding on for all it's worth. And there was a couple of times where I tried to just sneak out from behind him and have a little look. Your vision is kind of at an angle to either side of the rider. But
what
I wanted
ride.
To sneak out and have a look at it. It nearly wanted to rip you. Head off the wind speed. It was an amazing experience, mate.
Oh, yeah. That's incredible. I'd love to do that one day, but I don't know how I'd hold on.
Blow your mind. And it really reinforces just how good those guys are to do, you know, 340 k's an hour as they do every lap down there, to do nearly 30 laps, to do a Grand Prix for 45 minutes. Man, how they manhandle those things. And some of them, they're like jockeys, mate. They're 50 to 60 kilos. They weigh nothing, and yet they can. It's like child's play the way they ride those machines.
A lot faster than my 150cc Aprilia.
You don't do that down around Bondi, okay?
My little scooter. But I do want to get a proper bike eventually. I reckon in the next couple of months when I get my license back.
Yes.
Because I've had my scooter now. I've done the scooter thing for a few years.
Did you do a stay upright course, like a bike course?
I've done all that. I've got my opens now, but I just want to have a little test run on like a Harley. And maybe get a Moto Guzzi and have a look. Because they're the ones I like the look of.
Yep. Like a cafe racer. Is that sort
yeah,
of
stuff? Yeah, I think a cafe racer would be good just for, you know, burning to the city and back. What would you suggest?
Ooh, I could see you on a Harley. I think a Harley's a bit of you. What else might there be? Maybe a Royal Enfield, maybe Triumph mightn't be too bad. There's a few things around that would probably
Triumph. I like the sounds of a Triumph. I might have a crack at one of those.
Yeah, and it would look good too. Look good.
Well, thank you. Mm. You don't look so bad yourself.
No.
You Australian motorsport legend. Thank you so much, Greg Russ, for being a part of On The Mic. Being on the mic and being on the show.
It's been a pleasure to chat.
And good luck with all your future endeavours. I look forward to hopefully seeing you in Rod Morris's new movie. About Barry Sheen. You deserve to be in it. You and Baz were mates. You work together.
I would be happy just to see it. If they can do what they did with Rush or get close to that, it will be mega, mate. Great story.
Australian motorsports guru, thruster, Rusty, Greg Rust. Thank you for being on the mic.
Thank you, mate.
You've been listening to On The Mic with Mike Goldman. Subscribe, download and review at iTunes, Audioboom, Stitcher or your favourite podcasting app. For more, like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. This has been another quality podcast production from Bytes.com.